meeting will come to order. The meeting will come to order. The first item on our agenda today is approval of the agenda, and ask unanimous consent to add the president to the agenda when she arrives. We'd like to do that just before the provost speaks. And also one of our information items, I'll be presenting that information on unionization as opposed to Dr. Valdez. Any objections? Are there any objections? Hearing none, the agenda is approved. The next item on the agenda is approval of our August 27, 2019 minutes. Are there any changes? Hearing none, the minutes are approved. The next item on our agenda is the Faculty Senate President's report. I have a lot of different items to talk with us or to share today. No way to get through all of them in any great detail. To start with, at the Regents meeting, I wanted to point out something that that happened there. Mary Pat Kuig, I think I'm pronouncing her name correctly, is now going to be the Carter Fleck Endowed Professor in Nursing. And this is a remarkable professional that has chosen to join our faculty. And I think it reflects great credit on the Health Science Center in general, but the university at large, that we are attracting some really remarkable colleagues to our institution. The Jackson Weller's posthumous degree was approved, and Dr. Jessica Richardson presented her work on stimulating conversation with folk who've suffered from a variety of different types of dementia and the like, the work that she's been able to do there. We had the follow-up to our faculty governance retreat last Friday. I don't have the final tally of the priorities that we set there. That's homework that I didn't get to over the weekend. I apologize for that. But I will, once that's done, share that out with everyone. But I did want to say a word about what that faculty governance retreat agenda is about. I think there's some concern that we on Ops, or me, Finney, that we want all of those things that are on that list, that those are things that we're going to try to accomplish. If we could do that, we need to be at the United Nations, right? There's no way. There's no way, and that was never the intent, to lay out all of the things that we were going to do. What we wanted to see is those things that we have some shared priorities and focus on those things that we all tend to agree we need to focus on. There, even as we nail that down to one, two, or three per each of the categories, it's more than we're going to be able to do in any given year. However, I think you have to dream big. And we lay out those things that we want to try to accomplish, and we try to get as much of that done as possible. I just want to be clear about that. Later on, I'll present some information about the union vote, more about the procedures than anything. But for here right now, I want to say a little bit about the concerns that some folk have that the Faculty Senate is not taking a stand one way or the other, and that we're not providing perhaps the information that folk would like to have to make a more informed decision about this vote. Again, I'm going to have a little PowerPoint thingy. I'll share everything out that I know. I know the provost office helped me with some of this stuff. I did a lot of reading on my own, talked with ops, talked with our colleagues, pulled this together. So we'll share that information with everyone later on in the agenda. Everyone on our Faculty Senate has their own opinion about whether we should or should not unionize, right? We, from the beginning, have said that even in ops, we have different opinions about whether or not we should or should not unionize. But it would be a misstep for us as a body that does the work of the faculty to presume to dictate what the faculty should or should not do. And we will support getting out as much information so that our faculty can be as informed as possible about the decision, but we will not weigh in as a body on what we should or shouldn't do. Is that, I hope I'm making that clear, because there's some concerns that we're not doing something that I think expressly I don't think that we want to do, right? So we're going to provide as much information as we can. Sever, Warden knows here from COG, they're doing as much as they can to get information out to the faculty. And, you know, that's not our wheelhouse anyway. That's something that COG should be doing, and I believe that Sever and his colleagues are hard at work getting that stuff done. IPRA. Hello.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. You're fine. Sorry. Yeah, so... So on the IPRA front, we are continuing to have meetings about IPRA and feel that we don't yet have a clear-cut piece of guidance from University Council to share. The provost is also awaiting that information, and once we get that, we will share that out to the faculty broadly. But as it stands right now, I feel compelled to mention, and you know, this came up the last faculty senate meeting, but I want to reemphasize that as it stands right now, the law is very clear. Our notes, things that we, any kinds of communications that we have doing university business, that the notes, recordings, all of those documents are subject to IPRA. There are no protected documents that I'm aware of at this point. Of course, the university wants to be sure that we follow that guidance, follow the law, but also we want to make sure that where possible, the unique things that we do as an institution are recognized by the law, that there are conversations that we need to have protected in ways that the law currently does not protect them. So we'll continue to work with University Council to try to find a proactive solution to this so that we can, one, stay in compliance with the law, but also to make sure that our faculty know what their obligations are under the law as individuals. The next thing that I wanted to talk about, I scrolled up too far, is my visit out to the Gallup campus. And I think most of the administrators on campus, the provost, president, vice president for finances, have all been making these visits, sometimes together, sometimes individual, out to the branch campuses. As you'll know, one of the emphases that came out of our faculty governance retreat is working to actively strengthen the relationships between the branch campuses and the university. When I went on that visit, I kind of kicked myself because I think all of us, I really do genuinely mean this, should find a way to get out and visit our colleagues on our branch campuses. When you do, you will learn things about those campuses and the great people that are out there. I feel like Trumpian very right now. It's like they're all great people out there. Very Lake Wobegon here. But it is a remarkable amount of work that our colleagues are asked to do, and they are asked to do it under conditions that are absolutely remarkable. The 5-5 teaching load that they have, the limited access to support for research, et cetera, these are all issues that came up during my visit there. And we, I think, collectively as a faculty need to come back to the university. The provost was very kind enough to let me come in and vent about what I thought needs to happen, just some of the things that we probably could do in terms of supporting our colleagues at the branch campuses. In particular, I think as a faculty, one thing jumped out at me that I think that we can actually take on at some point and make some progress. A lot of our colleagues on the branch campuses are junior faculty, and they're going through their tenure process. And often the people who are experts in their area of interest, let me put it a different way, often they are the only experts in their area of interest on that campus. It would be wonderful if our younger colleagues, our junior colleagues, had access to other faculty members who have gone through that process that could help them along in that. I don't profess to know how that would work or how we would line that up, but it's something I think that as a faculty, we should not look to someone else to solve for us. Helping our colleagues get through that process is just one thing. Eddie Nunez has agreed to help us if we can get students from the branch campuses here to campus. They right now pay a different set of fees and different tuition, so they don't have access to everything that students on main campus have access to. But through the generosity of our athletics program, if we can get them here, they're willing to make sure that they get into, you know, athletic events and things like that. And I think we should continue to look for opportunities, not just for the students on those branch campuses, but also our faculty. There is a laundry list, and it would take me a long time to go through all of the things that came up on that trip to Gallup. Some of those things I will bring to our operations committee, and we'll talk through those and then bring back suggestions to this body about ways to proceed. But I wanted to let you know that I'd gone out on that trip and mimicking what Pamela did when she went on her trip to northwest part of the state. You have to go there to understand what's actually happening out there. And I honestly had no bloody idea. The other thing is, I don't know if I've seen a more breathtaking campus vista as the one you have going into their one of their main buildings. I don't remember the name of the building. The building that you're in?
SSTC, Student Services and Technology Center.
Uh-huh. Now, I've always pilfered the image at night of that building, but I had no idea where it came from. Mm-hmm. So it was wonderful to be able to see that. So great opportunities out on those campuses, and I hope that we can do more to take advantage of that. I have a shared item, if you will, in the president's report that I'm actually going to ask the provost if he will take the lead on. Last week we had an opportunity to see some of the numbers for our admissions and registration, and some of it has some really important consequences. And rather than muddle through it from my memory, the provost and Nicole Dobson agreed to come in and help us work through that. What we probably should do, the president has her report, is just as you suggested, and I didn't take your suggestion, roll it into your report if you don't mind. Okay. All right. Honors. In the coming weeks, months, this semester, and into the coming academic year, there's some really great opportunities for those of us who are very interested in honors to participate in the conversation about how we strengthen honors and build on this remarkable honors college that we have at the heart of our campus right now. There are elements of an honors program that aren't fully fleshed out. How do students coming in who don't have any idea about honors get into honors and leave with an honors designation? How does honors and honors education in the different colleges, how do we coordinate all of those efforts together? A task force is being pulled together, if it hasn't already been pulled together, and we'll look at those issues. I'll let the provost say more about that if he'd like to. So there's all that stuff out there with honors that's coming down the pike that we need to be concerned about. Budget request. We are going to make a budget request to the provost to support our special emphasis, finding different ways of supporting our incoming new faculty. One of the initiatives is trying to find a way to get the experts on our campus who know about the Grand Canyon to lead a group of faculty over into Arizona, have a look at the Grand Canyon, but then having literally the world's best tour guides to do that. And also local things, going up to the tram or out to the Jemez, a lot of different opportunities that we think would benefit our new colleagues on campus. But all of us would be welcome, I think, to go on those things too. I personally look forward to getting back to the Grand Canyon. I'd like to see that again myself, right? So that budget request will cover things that we want to do in the spring. So, for example, we put out feelers about starting this association of Mountain West faculty governance leaders, and the response has been overwhelmingly positive so far. And so hopefully we can find some resources to maybe bring some of our colleagues from these other institutions, maybe late next spring, bring them here to our campus and demonstrate some leadership in faculty governance and have some conversations with them. So those kinds of initiatives that we want to try to take up, we'll be asking for support from the provost on that. Won't put him on the spot and ask him for, hey, I need that check tomorrow, but ask for that support and go through that process. He was kind enough to share how we would do that. We're also going to put in a request for a permanent budget for the Faculty Senate. I don't imagine that it will be as robust a budget as we might like to get started, but at least to get started with something so that we as an organization have some autonomy and then resources to actually do some of the things that we as a group collectively decide to do. So that stuff is coming down the pike, and as I said, there are some other things on here that we can probably wait until later to talk about. And I don't want to open the floor for a discussion right now, but as we voted on earlier or consented to earlier, I'd like to offer the floor to President Stokes for her report.
I don't think I was actually on the agenda, so I'll be honest, I didn't prepare a report, but I just thought I'd come and hear what was going on for the period of time that I could. But, you know, I also don't want to duplicate what the provost is likely to say to you, so I guess I didn't get here for the first meeting of fall, so is this the second meeting for
yes.
the, and so I just want to say welcome to fall semester, and let you know just very briefly that what I'm working on right now a lot relates to our relationships with the legislature and state government, that we're working out our legislative priorities, and met with the council presidents last week, and we will continue to have as our highest priorities both an increase in funding for the universities via the formula and a compensation package. And there's some discussion right now about whether we're better off trying to roll a budget increase via formula and an allocation from the state as that would include compensation, or whether there would be we would ask for separate compensation. So there more to come, because all of these things are being discussed right now, but those really represent the top priorities that we are sharing with members of the legislature and you know, and other leaders in state government. So I'm meeting with people every week. Was in Santa Fe twice last week, testified in front of a committee yesterday, and so this is, you know, top for us. I think, you know, we continue to focus on some things that I started last year. I've got a campus safety task force that is working on possibilities that we'll share with the community. Really trying to figure out how we secure the campus, the buildings, and things like that. And I hear from you, a lot of people on this, but everything that we do, that we bring forward, will be something that gets vetted. So I was speaking to a Kiwanis Club at lunch today. I was, again, asked about, whether or not we were about to build a fence. You know, honestly, these are things that this campus security committee is looking at, but there is nothing really decided at this point, and once there is, there'll be campus discussion about whatever they end up bringing to my office for consideration. Obviously, we finished our leadership, or I finished my leadership searches. Now it's the provost's turn, so I know he's going to be talking about that, but, you know, really pleased to have brought some leaders to our campus, and, you know, they're already doing a great job. I am developing a strategic planning process. We're trying to bring in a couple of faculty and experts on our campus to help us figure out what's going to be the best strategy for engaging in strategic planning that is not really the run-of-the-mill regular strategic planning, but something that can really energize the faculty and staff and students on our campus for where we might be headed for the next 5 to 10 years. And then you, I write speech to enrollment. I don't always like to find that we're on front page news, but I think the article was well balanced, and we have our work cut out for us. But I know that James and Dan Garcia are really on top of this. So, don't want to take up too much time because I know you've got quite a bit on your agenda, but I'm happy to answer any questions. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'm wondering about if there's any talk at the legislation level about the free tuition. And yeah, that came to me from my constituents.
Okay, thank you. So, I think most all of us went into last week's higher education summit not knowing for sure what was going to be proposed, but knowing that there would be a big announcement. And so, I think what we are all looking at here is just a gratitude that the focus is on higher education. If you've actually heard the governor's speech last week, she was talking about how important higher education is to the state of New Mexico and its success. So by and large, we as leaders are just making sure that what we communicate is an awareness that this reflects a focus on higher education. In terms of the free tuition itself, I am aware that there's a group being put together that will hammer out the details, because truly the devil here is in the details.
Right.
And I think there was a proposal that this would be kind of the what do they call it, last in. As the model that would be used, but there's a lot of discussion. When I say last in, the proposal itself that was briefly explained last week was one in which all students would have the opportunity to have their tuition and fees covered by the state, but it would be the last dollar in. So the students were coming to the table with other sources of funding like Pell and scholarships, et cetera, that the state funding would be added on top of that until their tuition and fees were covered. And there are things to consider with regard to that's where the details really are. There'll be lots of perspectives about what's going to be best for New Mexico. And so we'll be engaged in that conversation. We're just trying to be part of evaluating this at this point and be part of how it actually gets implemented, if assuming the legislature passes it. So. Other questions for me? Thank you all.
Thank you. Next on our agenda item is the report from Provost Holloway.
Thanks. So let me start with first, hi. So apparently I should go to the Grand Canyon because I'm one of those new faculty who Penny was talking about since I started here in July. And so if we get that together, I am totally in. And I guess that gives me a reason to fund it.
There you go.
Thanks, and thanks for the opportunity to update you on some things that are going on. Let me just say first off, kind of at the meta level, the things that we want to focus on in the provost's office are really obvious things, but I think it's worth stating them. They're faculty success, student success, enrollment, staff development, and branch campus integration. Those are the things we're really focusing on that we make part of a conversation every day, every time we meet with my team, when we meet with others. Those are the topics we talk about with deans. Those are the topics we talk about with the president, with the senior vice president for finance and administration, and so on. So those are the key things for us. Related to those, then, just some brief updates. We do have 4 dean searches going on this year for College of Fine Arts, Anderson School of Management, Architecture and Planning, and College of Education. So we have quite a quite a lot going on in activity for dean searches. Those dean search committees have been mostly formed. We might add a member or two, but they are posted on the executive search website if you want to see who's leading those, who's on those search advisory committees. And we're using also, because we're doing so many searches at once, we're also using a search advisory firm to help us manage all of that and do those together. With respect to faculty success, some of you will have hopefully noted the conference support program that we rolled out to help colleagues go and present at national conferences. We know that there is a shortage of funds for that in some units, and so we rolled out that program. So far, 9 faculty have taken advantage of the first round of that and been funded to go to various professional conferences. I'm also doing a set of lunches with faculty, and so who knows, you might get an invite. We've set up the first of those already, and I'll be doing it basically monthly. I really want to get to know folks, hear what the opportunities and challenges are here. And the other thing that we've done around faculty is we have streamlined the faculty hiring process, which had a number of steps that we saw as onerous and unnecessary, and so we're trying to make the faculty hiring process much faster and more efficient, and so that's been rolled out this year as well. Just to talk about student success for a minute, because I will talk about enrollment as well, but the story about enrollment is not just a story about how many students are here. It's a story about what happens to them when they're here. Are they successful? Do they graduate able to achieve their own aspirations? So we're really happy to see that the retention from first year to second year, from into the third term, if you will, has gone up. It's about 77% overall. Equally importantly is the way that it's gone up within specific groups. And so for just to quote a few of these groups, and I won't do them from memory. So for our Hispanic students, that retention into the second year has gone from 72% to 76%. That's the direction we need to go. For American Indians, from 61% to 75%. So we're really seeing an improvement in retention into the third term. That's really important. It needs to be higher. So by no means are we done. Equally, our graduation rates, our five-year graduation rate is now over 50%. It's about 53, almost 54%. So that's a big accomplishment, too. It needs to be higher also. But nevertheless, we think it's really important to see these growing retention rates, these growing success rates. Six-year graduation rate is also up as well. And so student success is moving in a positive direction. But it's a really important piece of the puzzle for us. Let me talk a little bit about enrollment, and so there's good news and bad news. The glass is not half full or half empty, it is full. It's half full of air, it's half full of water, you need both to live. Enrollment overall, from our census, we're down about 6.5% compared to last year. It is not unexpected that we are down. We knew we would be down. With a large loss of first-year students last year, it was inevitable that we would be still lower this year. Some of that is made up through a number of transfer pathways. We've actually seen increased transfers from CNM and from the branch campuses. We haven't seen increased transfers overall, but we have from those particular pipelines, and that's important because those are our strongest partnerships for transfer. So if we can build on those and grow those, we can grow transfer. Also really interesting, we've seen a significant increase in transfer from out of state. And so that's something really exciting. I think that was unexpected, right? And so we knew we were really focusing on the branches and CNM, but the out-of-state was interesting. So we need to pursue that and see what we can build on there. Our freshman enrollment is down by about 59 students from last year. That's about 2%. That's actually pretty good. When you remember that huge drop we had last year and a real fear that there was just a titanic shift occurring, that's not happening. We're stabilizing, we believe, that first-year enrollment. That's good because we can start to build from there as opposed to building from a falling number. In fact, if you look at the long-term trend, enrollment at the university has basically gone like this. And we're actually back where we were about 10 years ago. We went through a counter-cyclic economic pulse of students. And it really, about 2008, suddenly we went up last couple of years, suddenly it went back down to where it was. So we do think we're actually seeing that competition between employment and school playing out in our enrollment. With Dan Garcia on as the Vice President for Enrollment Management, he's already stepped in and started to simplify some of the ways that students apply and come into UNM to improve the communications channels. Turned out we never talked to students in September before. September was a month of silence. And so we are now communicating with our prospective students in September so that we start to engage them, get them to apply, and when they do apply, they are and feel connected to UNM. So good steps going on. We are forming a enrollment management working group. We've got a tentative list of members for that will help us do several things. One, create expertise across a wide swath of the institution about enrollment issues and take advantage of the expertise that's here. Two, prioritize some of the recommendations of the enrollment task force that we had last year so we can implement the most impactful things starting now. And then three, create a strategic enrollment management plan that covers everything about enrollment, that covers our goals around first-year recruiting, our goals around transfer recruiting, international recruiting, out-of-state recruiting, graduate student recruiting, which is really important for us as well. And so that task force is forming now. In addition, Vice President Garcia is going to form a council for recruiters. We have a lot of folks doing recruiting, and we want to make sure that work is coordinated. And so that'll be happening as well. And then finally, a strategic financial aid working group to make sure that we're optimizing the use of financial aid. And so that group is also forming. Okay, so that's sort of where we are with respect to important updates. I want to talk about one of the consequences of enrollment in a minute, but let me stop and see if there are questions about any of those topics first. Yeah.
I'm curious, with the history of university and college enrollment increasing when you have economic downturns, in light of that, do you know if there's any research that suggests that maybe what occurred should have been expected? Or
you know, that's a great question, and I don't know what may exist in that body of research, but actually it's something that would be good for us to go and look at. And this trend, I should say, that we're seeing is something that we see across the country. So New Mexico may have been more sensitive in some ways, but it's not actually different from what you see all across the U.S. Any other questions about those topics? Okay, so I'd like to get your feedback on something. And so we're down 6.5%. That is more than we expected to be down. And in consequence, we've done this pretty much every year for the last several years. And that is we're starting to think about, okay, that means we have a budget shortfall. What are the principles by which we think about the allocation of that budget shortfall? So what I want to get feedback from this group on, either here or you can email me, is how do we think about the way we manage that across the institution? And there are a lot of slides here. I'm going to skip some of them quickly to get to kind of the end where we have that discussion. And so we have a projected shortfall of about $3.5 million from tuition. In addition, these may or may not be the right slides, but no matter, I can work with them. In addition, we have a shortfall of about $500,000 in student fees and mandatory student fees. It's actually $700,000, but we have a way to cover $200,000 of that because we set it aside in anticipation. So all told, we're looking at about a $4 million shortfall that we need to figure out what to do with. As we look at, okay, how do we manage that? We look across the university. One source of funds to work with is that there are reserves across the university. There are funds that are not specifically allocated to any particular purpose right now, and that's an obvious place to start with. You start by thinking about what do you do with your reserves. Now, some of our reserves people have plans for, right? And so I have reserves that are that I've earmarked for support for the Grand Challenges. The reserves, I could decide not to spend them on the Grand Challenges, but some of them are earmarked in that way. And then some are just not categorized yet, because it's always good to have a little bit of fun sitting around for the unexpected, to take care of an opportunity or a challenge. So one of the things we look at is pulling funds back from reserves as a way to manage this shortfall. And the challenge is those reserves are spread across the institution. We can find $4 million in reserves, we got it, but it's not in any one place. It's spread all over. And so we're trying to think about what are the principles for where we pull that from. And just to give you a sense of just the reserves, in the academic affairs units, the schools, the colleges, provost reporting units, there's about just under $15 million in reserves, of which 8.3 is dedicated. It's earmarked for something. In central administration and finance, there's about 8.5 million in reserves, of which 7.7 are allocated to something, some project to make sure the lights go on next week. Right? And so we need to figure out among those reserves, how do we think about pulling them back? And we think about this at two levels. The highest, sort of the level, what we call level two units, the provost in academic affairs, the president's office, finance and administration, student affairs, I may be leaving one out, but I got them all. So at that level, and then within each of those, there are subunits. And so we need to think about, okay, how much do we take out of academic affairs? And then for the amount we take out of academic affairs, how do we distribute that across provost reporting units, the schools and colleges? Sort of keep those two levels in mind. And we're trying to think about ways to do this that have some activity-based elements, that are based on some principles and not sort of arbitrary choices. And we want, since we're taking money away, we want to do this in a way that incentivizes good things, incentivizes the mission, rewards delivery of the mission, rewards teaching students, rewards delivering degrees, and that doesn't, and that can disincentivize poor practices as well. So we want to think about how we do this in a way that supports good behavior, supports good activities. And I'll mention a few models, right? And so one thing that you can do is look at reserves, and units should keep 10% to 16% reserves, 2 months of reserves around. You can pull back everything above some threshold. So if you've got money that's sitting in reserves above, say, 16%, just pull it back. So that would be one way to do it. That encourages units not to hold on to reserves that are too high. Don't hold on to lots of money, because the money is here to be spent on students and faculty and the work that we do. But on the other hand, then units that don't have reserves, and there are some, they don't contribute anything. So there's a sort of trade-offs in these choices. A different model is to tax reserves. So you might say, if you have anything above 10% of your reserves, we tax it. Okay? And you could do that differently. There's earmarked funds, funds that are really free. We could tax them at different rates, right? And so if you've thought carefully forward and your plan is to spend this money on these good things, we tax at a lower rate than if you've got money, lots of money just sitting around that's for which there's no clear plan. So this would encourage units with large reserves to maintain that relative position if you use a tax structure. So if they were really fiscally responsible and had lots of reserves, they maintain that benefit. On the other hand, if units have specifically designated funds, maybe we want to think about that differently. And yet still, units with no reserves do not contribute in a model like that. Something else we can do, and we've done all of these things in the past, is if you're a unit with a huge budget, we're going to pull back proportionally more from your reserves or other sources than if you're a unit with a small budget. So if your budget's twice as big as her budget, you're going to contribute twice as much to our shortfall as she is. And then all units contribute, whether they have reserves or not. And that may be a good thing. Right? Units without reserves are really operating in a... They've made some fiscal choices that mean that they're spending more than they actually have in resources. Maybe we shouldn't reward that. Right. So one other consideration, and We need $3.5 million that covers tuition. There's also a half million in student fees that are uncovered. Those student fees pay for things like Shaq. Those student fees pay for those student success programs that let our students graduate at above 50% in 5 years. Should the student fees, should we go to those student fee units and pull money away from them to cover this shortfall? Or rather, not getting the fees that we don't have? Or should we actually take some of the IMG money and pull it back to cover the student fee shortfalls? Another principle we're worried about. And we can blend all these approaches together. I won't get into the details of that. It's not an either or one of these things. And then one last point I'll make as we think about the academic affairs units, and particularly schools and colleges that do teaching and deliver on mission, should we be thinking about how do we think about distributing this kind of pullback across the academic affairs units, the schools and colleges? If you teach a lot of student credit hours, do we pull back more or do we pull back less? Something we've done in the past is if you're growing in student credit hours, then we're going to essentially give you a credit. We pull back less because you're growing, you have a greater need, there are students flocking to you. We shouldn't be penalizing that. That's a good thing. You're teaching more. We could do the same with graduations, numbers of students who are graduating. You're graduating more students than you did last year, then maybe we should be making sure we don't pull back extra funds from there. We should pull back less. Because you're graduating more students, you have greater needs because of that, and you're doing a good thing. You're graduating more students. So those are some of the considerations we're trying to build into this, and I know that's sort of a lot to absorb. But I do, with Finney's permission, like to hear reactions to some of these options, which best incentivize strategic planning and delivery on the mission. Are there other thoughts? How do we think about the way we pay student fee units and the need to find $500,000 to either cover them or tell them to do less? And so thoughts on these approaches, ideas? Yeah.
This seems to be an endemic problem at the university. Mm-hmm. And you're asking us to do your job. I don't want to hear your problem. Your job, in my view, is to make my life go beautifully, students' life go beautifully. I think we have an endemic problem of too much need and too little money coming in, and I would like people to start worrying about that.
So let me say, absolutely spot on, you're totally right. And so something else that Teresa Constantinidis and I are talking about is exactly this. We've gotten the history of these pullbacks over time. In some sense, it would be much better if we simply said, okay, next year we are planning smaller budgets so that we don't do these mid-year disruptions. Because we totally agree, having to do this as a mid-year disruption is a bad way to go. And the reason we wind up doing it this way is because these reserves are spread around and the costs are already there. The costs are built into this year. And so I just want to say that I agree, and we would like to find going forward a way to not do this again as a mid-year thing, because it's the wrong way to plan. Totally agree. Here and then over there.
So on the issue of punishing units that are not growing.
I don't like the word punishing, but okay.
Well, I mean, when it comes to incentivizing, there's the opposite of that as well. I think as long as we can understand that previous budget shortfalls actually might be the reason for some of these units not able to, for not them being able to go to the same high grade, because we've had these decisions over the last few years, and it really has hurt some units' ability to actually recruit students or teach more
students. That's a good point, so thank you. There are some hands over here. Yeah.
So I'm from the School of Engineering, and we have a lot of research centers, and I saw a lot of worrying about the academic units. I was curious if you also are thinking about the research centers as well, since we have so many.
Yeah, so since, because the funding shortfall we're looking at here is from student fees and tuition, and so it's ING money, so it doesn't touch research funding. We can't go in and take funds that came from the National Science Foundation, say, pulling that back for something else. And so this is only looking at, and can only look at, ING-funded units and units funded by mandatory student fees. Yeah?
It's been my experience that there's been a history in recent years of, for example, the Board of Regents telling the students what they're going to do with their fee money. And I know some students are upset by that sort of thing. So I know you talked about the student fees and the shortfall and so on. So I would just encourage whatever budgetary planning groups you're going to use to call upon input from the students. There's no student representation here, I assume.
Right. Yeah, I appreciate that. And the main group that we're talking about this with the budget leadership team includes student representation. So I agree with that. Back here.
Yeah. All your solutions appear to be a peanut butter solution, spread the pain all over.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, and looked at to look at what the requirements are, prioritize them, and cut the bottom off?
I think the question you're asking is, are there places where we simply say we're going to make judgments on particular programs that we should just cut? And I think there's a place for that. I'm not sure that it's sort of in this process we have to go through in the next few weeks to identify the shortfall.
Mm-hmm.
I think this point and yours are actually closely related.
Yes, sir.
Right? They're about, here's what we historically have been able to see we actually get in terms of revenue. How do we operate within that? And so, fair point. Thank you.
There's actually some questions.
Sorry, we're behind you.
Out here. Yes.
I just want to remind, well, your team, because you weren't here, but 10 years ago there was something called reserve harvesting, which I always liken to illegal organ donations, so I would say. And it was... But it was... indiscriminate at the time. I'm assuming you don't mean that. Often units will save money for future. You know, hey, we know we don't, I'll use my example, we don't need a trombone teacher now, but we know in a year we will need a trombone teacher, so we're saving that money for that. So I, as soon as I read that, I got hives from, you know, memories of the past. So I'm hoping you're really consulting. I guess John is a little bit going there. You went a little further than I would have, but an in-depth dive on how it can't be across the board, you know.
Yeah, and
even
and
the
that's
percentage.
That's why we're talking. Why we have deans as part of this conversation as well.
Yeah.
And no kidneys.
No kidneys. No, yeah, kidneys. But that trombone line might be a kidney for someone.
Yeah, and of course, one thing to recognize is that these are, in principle, this is a one-time thing. And so, in terms of, yeah, but
I'm just going to remind you, we've heard that for 20 years.
I get it.
You get to say that with a straight face, but we have to tell you. Yeah.
Well, I get to say that once.
Yeah, one time, right.
But so, what that means, of course, is in terms of hiring the trombone professor, in principle, the recurring funds are there.
By the way, we like our trombone professor. I should have picked another.
So, we're good on that. But I think it does come back to the longer term question that we have to really work on, which is what is the actual operating budget of our various units that we think is realistic?
Right.
Especially given that enrollment did this.
I know.
Right. And so we are back to a new reality that we have to work with. And we can try and grow, and that's the goal. One goal is to grow from that. But we have to recognize where we are.
And that's sort of Senator Matthews' point, right?
I agree. I think we've failed to truly recognize where we are.
Got it. Thank you.
I think there were some other things. Yeah.
I just want to also piggyback on student fees. I find that to be the most horrific area to cut because I feel that doesn't really speak to student success. So I feel like health and wellness and SHAC are absolutely vital. And not only that, if we're going to cut that budget and then give them less, that makes it even more, it almost just egregious to charge them the same, but they get less services. And also, again, that's really our mission. And I feel like it's a tax-the-rich plan in terms of taking from the departments that have the most money. I don't know what that means other than I feel that HSC will be involved.
So with respect to student fees, I have that same concern, right? And so we look at I specifically shared these data about student success, right? And so that growing third-term retention rate, that growing five-year graduation rate, that's, of course, because of the work of our faculty, but it's also because of the work of those student fee-funded
programs. And their experience
programs.
On campus and what's offered to them. You know, I do think that that's
so
important.
So I share that concern. Other comments? Yeah.
Similar idea here, and actually Finney and I talked about this last Friday when he was visiting our campus. A lot of our students transfer from Gallup, come to this campus, and they don't feel like they're included in the broader campus community. They kind of fall through the cracks. So this is not going to make up a significant, you know, $500,000 shortfall, but if there was an investment in the sort of student support to integrate some of those transfer students, to give them a sense of feeling like they're part of the community, we won't lose them. So we not only have either their lottery scholarship funding, their tuition funding, the FTE, you know, funding that comes from the state.
Yeah.
So it might be worth investing a little bit more in some of the student support in these particular areas if it means longer term
things
down the line.
Thank you. Yeah.
I would like to hear the plans for growth.
In terms of student enrollment?
Yeah, I hear every year that money's going away. That's fine. I want to hear about growth. Mm-hmm. I'm not okay with the fact that things are declining.
Yeah.
So what are the plans for growth?
Sure, and so that's the primary reason that we've brought in a vice president for enrollment management, which is a position that's been in an interim space for quite some time. And so we've brought in someone who has successfully grown enrollment at several other universities where he's been. And that's the pieces around even things as simple as if you read our admission requirements, let me turn this into a story. We have students at very good high schools in Albuquerque who read our admission requirements and they say, I can't figure out how to get into UNL. Never mind. It turns out our admission requirements are graduate from a New Mexico high school, there's one other piece, I forget what it is, it's not even have a certain GPA, it's graduate from a New Mexico
ACT
high school, have a certain ACT or SAT
yeah.
score. It's really simple, but our explanation of it is confusing. And students from very good schools are saying, what? So that's one, right? Another, there's some amazingly simple things we should do. Another is the tuition that we put online is not the tuition students will pay, right? So we put online our base tuition for in-state and our base tuition for out-of-state. Most students don't pay that. 80% of our students coming from out-of-state have some kind of tuition deduction. Another percentage for in-state off the top of my head, but a whole bunch from in-state pay less. We don't present that. When I first was looking at that, coming here, I looked at the New Mexico State page. Their page says it costs $20,000 to come to New Mexico State if you pay full freight, but actually the average student in state pays $10,000. Our page said you pay $23,000. So those kinds of changes that will encourage students to apply, and then I mentioned the communications channels. That's not just about getting students to apply. The process of a 17-year-old choosing a college is an emotional decision. We have to be connected to them. We have to send them personalized messages. Those are the things that Dan is doing and putting in place, as well as starting to think more strategically about coordinating our recruiters. We have this, we show up at a high school for recruiting, and they say, oh, your other recruiter was, this is literally true, your other recruiter was here this morning. We are not deploying our resources well. Right? So those are some of the things we're doing.
So we're a bit over on time.
Thank you. This has been very helpful.
But we can take one more last question. We have one. Seeing none. Thank you.
Cool.
Thank you. Okay. And we don't have Laura Stone here, right?
Yes.
Oh, there she is.
Okay.
All right. All right. Next item on our agenda is an action item regarding the faculty handbook policy D-175, and we'll have Laura explain a bit about what we're trying to accomplish here and then we'll call perhaps for a motion. Yes?
Right. A very brief explanation of both D-175 and D-176. They're very similar. And then turning it back over to the operations committee, you have the material in the agenda package. You had a timeline going back 20 years. I won't call it back 20 years back. You had a memorandum that was a great narrative, and then the actual revised policies that are about 20 pages each. So over the past 2.5 years, the Faculty Senate Policy Committee has been working on revisions to the Faculty Handbook Policies D-175 and D-176 to address concerns raised by the Department of Justice in 2016. These were about inconsistencies with the student grievance procedures and the Pathfinder. These discrepancies arose when the Pathfinder student grievance procedures were amended in 2015 and 2016 without approval from the Faculty Senate. Or without notification to the Faculty Senate. And in the timeline, you've got the details. And like I said, I'll just mention a few things. I won't go back 20 years. In 2016, there was a letter to President Frank stating that student grievance procedure in the Pathfinder was in violation of a part of Title IX. And then there was a task force that was formed. Faculty Senate Policy Committee appointed task force started working on revisions. There had also been a UNM Department of Justice agreement signed that we would address their concerns. So the task force starts in 2016, it starts working, and then sometime in 2017, the issue of alignment kind of rises to the surface. So it ends up in the Committee on Governance. So the Operations Committee puts it on hold, it goes into the Committee on Governance, so that they can study the relationship between the Faculty Handbook and the Pathfinder, which were linked, right? So that's why we were also responsible for the discrepancies. So after it stays in the Committee on Governance for a while, finally about 2018, it starts going through the revision process again in the Policy Committee. In spring 2019, right, it went out for the final comment period to the campus. In June of this year, this summer, the Faculty Senate Policy Committee reviewed the comments that we got back from the campus comment period. We addressed concerns that were expressed by the Dean of Students, the Vice President of Student Affairs, the Student Affairs Chief Operations Officer, and you have that in the agenda package as well, that thread. So, at that time, also in June, the Policy Committee voted to move it to the Faculty Senate for approval, that the revisions were ready for approval. All right, so since the Policy Committee worked extensively with all the stakeholders, the proposed drafts went out for campus comments, and all the comments were addressed, the Policy Committee requests the Faculty Senate approval of those attached proposed policy revisions, which are about 23 or so pages long each. They're very long policies. And they're in the package, and they've been out to campus comments, and we address those comments. As mentioned, the attached proposed revisions, D-175, which is undergraduate student conduct and grievance policy, and D-176, which is graduate and professional student conduct and grievance policy. Those proposed revisions address faculty and student concerns while also aligning with the Pathfinder student grievance procedures and the OEO claims procedures. Our policy committee thinks that believes it's critical that those revisions be approved by the Faculty Senate and posted to the Faculty Handbook promptly. It's been in process for several years. So today, the policy committee is requesting that the Faculty Senate approve the revised D-175 undergraduate student conduct and grievance policy and the revised D-176 graduate and professional student conduct and grievance policy.
We'll take the 175 and 176 one at a time.
Okay.
Do I have a motion to take up Faculty Handbook Policy D-175 for a vote?
So moved.
Do I have a second?
Second.
It has been moved and seconded that we
adopt
Faculty Handbook Policy D-175. Is there any discussion?
Just a question. Is this action item one?
This would be action item, the first action item.
Well, yeah, are you counting these?
Actually,
how many do you have there?
One, two.
We have five.
That's what I'm looking back at, yeah.
Three, four, where are we on the action
five.
Item?
Three, four. All right, we're on the...
D175.
It's not marked on.
It must be three, then.
Yeah, I believe it's three.
It must be three, because there are only five total.
Yeah, that's,
so,
it's,
yeah.
Sorry, thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, we had so, this
problem before. So this would, on your cards, this would be action item number three. Again, it's been, wait a minute, is there any discussion? Hearing none. We'll go to a vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, the motion carries. The next item is our faculty handbook policy D-176. Laura, do you have any additional information on this?
It's they were all kind of revised. Both were revised simultaneously. Very similar. It's just D-176. Like, it has language that specifically addresses graduate professional students.
Do I have a motion to take up Faculty Handbook Policy D-176 for a vote? Do I have a second?
Seconded.
It has been motioned and seconded that we take up Faculty Handbook Policy D-176 for a vote. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion carries. Thank you, Laura. But before you go, the amount of work that went into this policy has just been astounding. And we really appreciate the policy committee, one, your patience with it going through, taking as much time as it has to go through. But it's an important policy. It needed the kind of review that it had. Thank you for the hard work on policy. I hope you'll share that with the committee. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. We have a consent. We're moving to our consent agenda topics. Form C from the Faculty Senate Curricular Committee. This comes as a consent item. Do I have a motion to adopt?
Sorry.
It comes from Ops as a consent agenda item. Do I have a motion to take this form up for a vote?
To adopt this
this Form C.
So moved.
Thank you.
Do I have a second?
Second, you got it.
It has been motioned and seconded that we accept Form C from the Faculty Senate Curricular Committee. There are two of them there. C-2418, MS in Architecture, and C-2285, MA Language Literacy and Social Cultural Studies, Concentration TESOL. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion carries. We're at 407.
And that should be number, what, five in your,
yep.
Right, you just did 3, 4,
yeah.
5.
Yeah, so we should, that should be all five of our action items. The next item on our, or we have, we're moving to our information items, and this is number 8, the union vote information. I come back to my points earlier that the Faculty Senate, or at least the operations and then myself, we want to provide as much information as possible to our faculty regarding the unionization voting process. We need the cable here if we can get that to work. Now, a word about this presentation before I get into it. It's not not imagined, at least, to be perfect. And hopefully, let's see if we can get that up there. All right. I would ask you, there may be places where we have incorrect information or the like. I hope that we can politely point those things out, and we will change and adjust those things as we need to so that we have the most accurate information that we can share with some of our other faculty or with our fellow or with our colleagues, all right? So this is where, these are our voting times and locations, October 16th and October 17th. You can see that there are five different locations where the vote will be held. Give people a moment to read over those. Some election information. I think it's important for us to note that that this will be an election that will be administered by the American Arbitration Association. The UNM Labor Management Board will be present at that vote and oversee it. There are two elections being carried out at the same time. Faculty will only be allowed, obviously, to vote in one of those. We're hoping to have the list of eligible voters posted no later than October 2nd. Absentee ballots. If for some reason you need an absentee ballot, or we know of colleagues who need an absentee ballot, they must email the UNM Labor Board at comcast.net, and they must receive that email no later than the 1st of October. Okay. Does anyone who may know this process better than I do, or other folk that I've gotten information from, see any errors or corrections that we need to make on this? Yes, it's good?
Looks good.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
About the two separate votes?
Yes.
Why are there two?
I'm going to explain it in just a second, why there are two. So there are two separate bargaining units, and so you would find out which bargaining unit you would participate in. Here's the continuing faculty bargaining unit. These are all the folk on main campus who hold these titles.
Main and branch,
I'm sorry. And then adjunct faculty make up the second bargaining unit. There's a pretty large list of people who are not included. If we can read over these folks.
Why are HSC not eligible?
Okay. So there have been a couple of different, people have speculated or asked about that. My best understanding is that as people canvassed and looked around, there didn't seem to be the same kind of interest perhaps on North Campus, or that it didn't look like that HSC would have a great interest in unionizing, right? And that...
No.
Okay.
Can we have Brandy speak to that? Perhaps?
Yeah. Let me finish. That's one speculation, right? Another speculation is that folk, as they were organizing, thought strategically it would be better not to include HSC because there would be no interest in that. Now, whether HSC was actually contacted and said, hey, we don't want to be a part of this, I don't know that to be true. And with that, I might turn to my colleagues who know better than I do about that. So there are kinds of, I think there's a lot of information and misinformation out there about how that process went down, right? So can you say more about that, Brandy?
Well, from the best of our information, no one in the health sciences was consulted about it. Partly that's because we have different contract structures and we have performance-based pay. So this would de-incentivize our contracts, essentially, and would do away with the performance-based incentives that we have that are built into our contracts in the health sciences. And that's pretty common amongst health science centers to have those types of structures to their faculty contracts.
Okay. Yes.
My name is Billy Brown. I'm on the organizing committee for United Academics UNM. It's my understanding that as for quite a few years now, as people on the faculty explored the idea of unionizing, members of the faculty were sought out who might be interested in working towards this, and very few, if any, members of the HSC faculty expressed an interest in working towards it. So it's my understanding there simply wasn't enough interest on the part of faculty members who were contacted, some of them. I'm not saying everyone was, but very few, if any, HSC faculty members were interested in helping organize the process.
Okay.
Matt, I have a question.
Yes.
Matt Ruggo, College of Pharmacy. So there's some confusion in our faculty. I've received 6 emails, so there was an email that went out to the faculty list, which talked about the vote. And so some of our faculty think we're now involved with the vote, and I keep saying we're not involved with the vote. So I don't know if there's a way to filter it out that those back correspondence only go to the voting people, but it's creating a lot of confusion, at least in our colleges.
Well, I think it was sent out for informational purposes, and if they read to the through the entire email, they would have said clearly that this excludes all health sciences faculty there. And then Anne had a question on it.
So I just want to make sure, because I think I'm a little confused, that that historically there wasn't an interest in unionizing that from HSC, and so they weren't included in the vote. That sort of sounds like, I'm probably just getting too old, but it sounds like, well, you aren't able to vote because your initial interest was not in unionizing, as opposed to, for very understandable reasons, you may not have the support for unionization from the Health Sciences Center, but is that reason enough not to include? What is the percentage of faculty HSC has?
Oh, it's over a third. Yes, it's a huge amount.
I'm confused, Bill, if you could clarify for me what it was you were saying.
Matt?
Yes.
So there was a negotiation between the administration of the university and those of us organizing the union. And one of the results of that, negotiation was that the HSC would not be included. And so I don't think any of us who are organizing the union wouldn't love to have HSC involved. It's just that there wasn't enough interest on the part of faculty from HSC to warrant spending our time and energy trying to get more interest in HSC. And then the bottom line was, when there was a final negotiation between those organizing the union and the administration of the university, the bottom line was HSC was not included. So that was a decision negotiated between organizers of the union and the administration of the university.
With all due respect, that doesn't ring true with what has been said in this very room. I have stood next to people who were organizing who specifically said that this was a strategic decision. Look, I don't care that it was or wasn't. I just think that we need to be intellectually honest about how we got to this spot. And again, in terms of folk on North, there are plenty of colleagues on HSC who are actually interested in unionizing. So I think, I'm not saying that you are being disingenuous. I'm saying that we would have to take a second look at any argument that HSC was fully given an opportunity to participate in this process. That simply isn't true. What happened is that the group of people who organized this, and I think there are other folk in the room who can speak to this, there were reasons why HSC was left out other than they just did not have any interest. And so I'll leave it at that. I'd like to continue with this. The bargaining units are with that, frankly, at this point is water under the bridge, because the university did enter into a negotiation, just as you said, and came to an agreement on these bargaining units. So we might go back and, you know, Monday morning quarterback how we got to them, but we have 2 bargaining units at this point, right? And we have to take a vote based on those bargaining units. Whether we like how we got there or not, it's actually a moot point at this point. So these are the folks. Yes, Lee.
Two questions. One is, and I'm not volunteering to vote, but if you're an HSC faculty member with a secondary appointment in the School of Engineering, are you included in the vote?
It's primary appointments.
Primary.
Wherever your primary appointment is.
And the second question is, there's been talk that if the union is indeed formed, that they have the power to annex involuntarily the HSC faculty into the union. Mm. Can somebody speak to that?
From what I understand, and because that was a concern that I had, I was told definitively that could not be the case. Mm. Now, I could be that the person who told me that could have been wrong. I could have bad information. But is there anyone here who has a more definitive answer on that? Yes.
It's the case that later on the HSC faculty could be included, but the HSC faculty would then have to go through sort of the same sorts of steps that the general faculty has gone through in order to qualify to have an election to include themselves.
But that would have to be initiated by HSC faculty. The union couldn't just come in and and say, okay, we're taking over. You're now, whether you like it or not, part of the union.
Correct.
So in the future, if that happens, we can come find you and take your stickers.
That should be made better known, because there are a lot of rumors going around.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's something that we can amend this,
right,
and add that language
for clarity.
Okay. Here's the voting procedure. You have to bring your ID to the vote. We will be given enough time. This is taking place over a two-day period. And if for some reason you have difficulty getting away, you can ask a supervisor. I don't imagine we'd be in a situation like that. But for time to get away to vote, you'll be given, we're told that you'll be given that opportunity. Standard electioneering practices. There'll be observers there managing the polling place. I think you can read this as well as I can. Processes for challenging the voters. I don't know what that challenge is. If someone, I don't know, you walk up.
Can I give an example?
Yes.
If I go vote, it should be challenged. So it's that kind of thing.
But the procedure isn't you're taken out behind a shed or something. And
oh, God, I hope not.
All right.
I thought it was challenging.
It's the organ donation.
Well, that's what I thought too.
That's where the harvesting
comes
in.
One kidney, come on.
Okay.
And so if somebody observes something and think is improper, they can challenge it. It doesn't mean the person still votes. It's just voting in elections.
Sure.
And the labor board gets to look at it.
Yes, sir.
Why do we have to show photo ID? We don't have to in New Mexico.
Well, because you could have folk voting that aren't faculty.
We have voters in New Mexico.
Yeah, right. You just think the standards are higher here.
Yeah, we're...
Well, there's an identification process that takes place at your polling place.
They ask me my name.
Wow. They ask you to verify some information about your address, too. I mean, it's...
And sign.
But, in California, there are thousands upon thousands and thousands of illegal voters. I don't think we'll have that problem. But I do think that it's wise for us to be able to demonstrate who we are. It's not a huge... deal to bring your ID.
You're supposed to have it anyway. If you're on campus.
You can't buy alcohol without it, and this seems to be.
Which ID are we talking about? Up until a moment ago, I was assuming it was my UNM ID,
I think if it's your.
It's written as a photo ID.
Yeah, that's what it says, a photo ID. I'm planning on bringing my UNM ID.
Yeah.
And if they say.
Card. Driver's license.
Yeah,
All right. So the labor management board is a relations board is going to certify this election. They'll get the ballots, etc., and they'll certify that election by Friday, October 18th. These are the numbers. This is kind of fascinating, right? That the continuing faculty unit is approximately 1,000. Those obviously aren't exact numbers. So a minimum number of 400 people must vote in order for the election to be legitimate, right? If 399 people vote, assuming, of course, this is not the number, but you have to have that percentage, right? 40% of the vote. And then adjunct faculty, these are the numbers, and so this would roughly be these would roughly be the numbers based on that 40%. Right. Here's the these are the thresholds that have to be met. And then once those thresholds are met, it's a simple majority. Oh, you said there's no such thing as a simple
majority.
It's a majority.
Yeah. A complex majority.
And then a tie vote is a vote for no collective bargaining representation. And then a little bit of what does it mean to have a yes vote? I think this is important, right? And I'll just leave this up so folk can read through through this. I'll read it. If the Labor Management Relations Board certifies the vote as yes union representation, the union will become the bargaining unit's exclusive representative. There is no specific timeline for the parties to start collective bargaining negotiations to develop an initial contract. This initial contract, the contract discussions, will start when either party gives appropriate notice to the other requesting that negotiating commence. Discussions will continue until UNM and the union reach a tentative contract. Union membership will ratify or reject that tentative contract. Yes?
Do we have or can we get a copy of this presentation?
Yes. Yes.
We can send it.
My thought is if we don't have if this is clean, then I'll simply post, we'll ask Rick to post it to, we'll send everyone a copy of it.
All of our
faculty senators. And with the idea, of course, that you would share this with your departments and the like. That's why I'm asking for, if we have errors, to point that out to us. This is our best guess at things right now.
Yep.
So what does it mean for a no vote? A no union vote. If the Labor Management Relations Board certifies the vote as no union representation in either of the proposed bargaining units, that bargaining unit will not form. The union may opt to repeat the entire process of seeking a vote by collecting new showing of interest cards. I think that's like one of those quotation things, right? Filing a petition and other things as required. There are other things that aren't listed here that they would have to do, but those are the big ones, right? And we'll clean up the grammar stuff before we send that out. There's a 12-month waiting period before the union may call for a new election. Does that ring true for the folk who are involved in the process? We will not include this in what I send you, but this is an FYI for us as faculty senators so that we know, right? And if you want to share that information beyond, you're happy to do that. I think some people might see this as some kind of presentation bias, right? But we do need to know that there have been two, there's been a hearing and now there's actually a lawsuit. So the Labor Management Relations Board hearing that was held on August 29th, the union requested that the board order UNM to provide it with personal contact information for certain UNM faculty who would fit into that collective bargaining units. Now, what concerns me about that is we don't have that list completed yet. So I'm not sure how they could have been asked for that information if we don't know yet who would have been on the list. Maybe it was just that they wanted that information more generally speaking. UNM argued for the protection of this information. The Labor Management Relations Board ordered UNM to, and in fairness too, I think that the union wanted that information because they wanted to be on a level playing field with the university, that the university had access to that information and could use it. They wanted access to that information. But the question was, I guess, for the Labor Management Relations Board was, you know, the university had not used it and promised that it would not use it. If I'm, I think I have that right. So the Labor Management Relations Board ordered UNM to produce employee work email addresses and work telephone numbers, but not home addresses, personal cell phone numbers, or personal email addresses. UNM complied with the Labor Management Relations Board order and provided the union with work emails and work telephone numbers for UNM faculty who are potential members of the two bargaining units. UNM did not provide the union with personal contact information about faculty, home address, personal cell phone, personal email. However, the union filed suit against UNM on September 5th, seeking a court order requiring UNM to release personal contact information about certain UNM faculty, home address, personal cell phone numbers, and personal email addresses. The state court will hear the case on October 2nd, 2019. That's the current lawsuit. That's it. Any... I hate to even... Yeah.
Go ahead. I
could just say any questions. Just to keep
your question. Yeah. Any questions, please?
I do think it's possible, given my colleague in pharmacy's point, that it might be useful to, again, send out information, not with it on the bottom, but in bold red on the top, that HSC faculty cannot vote.
Yeah, we can add that to this.
And will not be bound by the outcome.
Yeah, and very good point.
I think both of those things, and it's possible we don't read all the way to the bottom, but...
Oh, it should be in the subject line.
In the subject line, exactly. If you're at HSC, don't bother reading. No, good idea.
I saw. I saw other hands. I saw another hand here first. No. Yes.
I would just like to add that the absentee ballots, they need to be requested by October 1st, but they need to be received by the 17th. Okay. So, if you're going to request an absentee ballot, make sure that it's submitted and received by the 17th to be counted in the count.
Okay.
Is there a problem, do you think, that your ballot would be, your absentee ballot would be due the 1st, but the compilation of the final list is not till October 2nd? Is there any trouble in that? I found that a discrepancy.
Oh, that's a good point.
It is.
Yeah, so maybe and that needs to be extended.
So, hopefully we'll have the list before the 2nd. But I think if someone, based just on their title, is sees themselves as being in one of the bargaining units and knows they're going to be away or whatever the issue is, it doesn't hurt to request the absentee ballot.
I understand. It just feels unfair to require it before you've actually anointed them. I would change the date of the request for the ballot. Extend
it. Yeah, I'm not sure that can
be. Oh, okay. Well, that seems unfair.
So, but the vote needs to be received by the 17th.
By the end of close of voting for us.
Okay.
It can't be postmarked, it has to be received.
Yeah. And Nora was over there.
I don't know what order.
Yeah, I don't either.
I think it was Nora. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, just really briefly, in the email, you also have to include the address. So I don't know if you're not, everybody's busy, you can't just write an email and say, I need that message about it. The whole thing has to be complete email that you need to agree with.
Where to send it, Nora?
A paper copy?
There's so many of the absentee ballots that you can put in.
Uh-huh.
So in your email, you need to mention what address to send it to.
So, but then that we have the postmark thing. So it has to be postmarked by?
No, it has to be received.
It has to be received.
Because they'll be tallied that night.
That doesn't seem quite fair either.
Yeah.
I see you, but...
I just had a question about whether or not there's any information on provisional ballots. So we heard a little bit about challenge ballots, but what if someone's name doesn't appear, but rightfully should appear? Is there a process for a provisional ballot? Because it would be important for people to know that in advance, should their name not appear, but they presumably have a right to vote. So I don't know if that could be included as a slide.
How much
not
time
only the
do we
challenge,
have? We don't have
but
enough
also
time.
The provisional process.
We just don't have enough time.
And who knows what that process is specifically?
How would we...
It's pretty much
well, the
you've described
is also
it,
taking
as I understand it. You can come, you're not on the list. You say, I should be on the list. They're cast a provisional ballot.
So that's a that is part of the process.
That's in play. Great.
I'll double check that. That's
okay. So could there be a slide describing both the challenge and the provisional process, just so that people are aware of that?
She's got it.
Okay, got it. And I saw Stefan.
Yeah. So I'd like to see as to whether the unions' activities are going to be limited to the collective bargaining, or as to whether the purview of this process will extend to other domains, as the website potentially suggests.
I'm not sure I understand.
So there was some language to the effect that the union might also work on topics related to faculty senate. Is that correct or not?
I think that there are many people who are organizing union who may have issues with faculty involvement in university governance, and so it's possible that whatever bargaining position we formulate to bargain with the university may include some items having to do with faculty governance or university governance and faculty participation.
Okay. You had your hand up.
Yeah. The way I heard it, now I could be mistaken about this, but the way I heard it is the lawsuit is requesting to direct the University Labor Management Relations Board to then request or direct the university to release this personal information. So I think the lawsuit is directed sort of in opposition to the Management Labor Relations Board, not directly in
actually, okay. both the university and the Management Labor Relations Board are named as whatever the legal term is.
Yes.
The parties in the lawsuit.
Okay.
Awesome. I think I can offer a point of clarification. I'm still long. I'm a lawyer and librarian at the law school. The lawsuit is essentially asking that the district court have the labor board comply with the law. It is the union's contention that the labor board has failed in its decision related to that contact information to comply with essentially 50 years of federal law precedent as well as state law precedent as it relates to this question of the release of that information. It's pretty standard that information be released. And the decision to not ask the union to release that particular contact information was the board didn't provide any explanation or rationale for its decision. So essentially, we're asking that the court ask the board to provide an explanation, and then the court's going to look at their explanation and make a determination about whether or not the board actually followed the law.
I see.
And so that's what's happening with that case.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Yes.
Okay, so I have some questions from the School of Engineering. And the first one was about, we have a lot of people who have centers and are also academic program directors. So, for example, one of them was wondering, am I going to be excluded because I'm a center director or an academic program director, even though I'm not a chair? Because we have, for example, in my department, one department that has three graduate programs underneath it, so they're not all the department chair.
So from what I understand, both there's some back and forth, hopefully even as we speak, between the union and the university to go over that list of people who would and wouldn't be included.
Okay.
So I think on the individual, I assume, and I can ask the provost others, that it's true, we're literally talking about a list one by one, person by person. Right, so you'll be able to check your name against a list beforehand to see if you would be included in the collective bargaining agreement.
And then there was another question about
the role of research faculty who are often really short-term being included in with, they're on the second set or the first set? Okay, so the comment is, changes in the employment of research faculty could have significant negative impact on the research being carried out in engineering, since many of these are short-term contracts. Furthermore, they bring in their own funds, usually since they are principal investigators and determine their own salaries. So there's a question of why those members were included with tenure-track faculty.
From what I understand, the union would be, if we vote yes for a union, everyone who's in that category, their salaries would be negotiated through the union, if I'm not completely mistaken. Whether they want that to happen or not, that's what's going to happen. Yes, sir.
Just, I add that a professor of practice, which I think can have been biological engineering, has 25 of them, they don't draw salaries.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, the union, salaries is as part of what the union does, right?
Yeah,
the
union. Workforce and the, you know,
yeah, right.
Got it.
Yeah.
And I don't understand how that list was compiled. I mean, it was compiled without consultation.
Well, it was compiled through negotiation.
Okay,
with,
so in that case, the university management, the unions, they were discussing our future without consulting us.
I don't know how you could get beyond,
because I wasn't consulted in terms of if I wished to participate in this process.
That's a truth.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? And the other thing is that will we have a mass emailing list saying vote no? Because I got one saying vote yes, and I pretty sure that went to the whole of the university. So what is going on here?
Well, I think, objectively speaking, and just, you know, staying away from one side or supporting one side or the other.
Process irregular.
Right.
That's, you know, lawsuits can follow.
Today
we got an email saying, please vote yes.
So there is no.
It was sent through UNM.
Right. And.
And the provost did send out an email or send out his letter.
No, not the provost.
Right. There aren't parallel structures here. So there isn't a parallel structure anti-union that is out lobbying on behalf of people who don't want to be a part of the union, right? So essentially, the mechanism by which faculty who do not want to be a part of the union, their mechanism to voice their opinion is the ballot, and to go out and to vote. So for us, it's important to get information out that is objective about the process at this point. There are plenty of resources out there that tell you what unions do, what unions don't do. The union has a page that has a lot of information about the benefits of being in a union and the like. I invite everyone who is curious to go out and read as much as possible about the process and about the responsibilities. Now, one thing that I have asked for that I have not received is an answer to three basic questions that I haven't received from our administration or from the union. And I think answering these three questions, at least for us as faculty governance leaders, is going to be important. It'll certainly be important to me as I cast my vote. The first question is simply this. What is it that the union would do that is not being done on our campus, right? The second question is, what is being done on our campus that the union would now assume responsibility for? And then third, very simply, what are the things that we will be working on together? I think an intellectually honest answer to that set of questions, I think the administration and the union, I think, should be working together to provide that information for our faculty. But I've asked that question many times, or that set of questions many times. I've yet to receive a response that is of any
quantifiable.
Substance.
Yes.
Lee's had his hand up.
Yeah.
He's going to get cramped.
So, not being involved in this process, I do have a question. If there is a somewhat organized group of anti-union faculty, should they have access to the same email list as the pro-union, as the union organizers? And I assume that might go through the provost's office. And have you been approached, or has anyone...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think that there's a parallel organization.
I can answer no. I've not been approached for such a list. Our ability to provide such a list, we would have to just add in terms of state labor law. It's not a parallel structure, and it's by design not a parallel structure. Unions are typically working from against an organization that has a. There's
but
a power
this isn't
there's
an
a
organization.
Power
this is another group of faculty.
Yeah. I want us to finish up this, and I don't. We don't want to go down the rabbit hole on this one. Just yes.
As you said,
there is fair.
If when the list of people comes out, you find you're not on it. Where do you go to complain?
Yes. So well, I think the first thing that you do is you go and vote. You go because there's a provisional ballot that if you go to wherever the polling place is, you can always fill out that provisional ballot. You want to get that in. The complaining can come after the fact, but you want to get the provisional ballot put in, and then you have that in the record. Yes.
On October 2nd, there's going to be a list.
Right at
yes.
that point, who can
if
he complain?
At that moment, you feel you
right.
are not. Can you not do something immediately?
Yeah, I think you could contact either the union or the university and raise the point so we can figure it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's only reasonable.
Well, I would love if whatever you post, it says immediately send you
right, sure.
to some email site. I have been misclassified. I think people will be misclassified.
Call.
It's just I can't do this by myself.
No, I guess. I cannot do it. Is it Duncan?
Yeah.
I'm going to call for Finney here. Yeah, he's writing.
I just wanted the comment about the email sent out to all the faculty that encouraged people to vote yes. A couple of my colleagues, I'm HSC, right. so of course you have yet, but a couple of my colleagues had asked me about it too. And the email was the email regarding absentee ballot information. And the link in that email linked to the UAUNM.org website, which has the text on that website does not say vote yes. However, there are next to it a number of advertisement style banners that say vote yes and cows faculty voting yes.
I
can understand how that would seem odd if that was coming out on the faculty.
Yeah.
All
yeah. Who sent that? I feel like I didn't actually get that.
You said UNM.
Yes.
Oh, okay. So they have our work.
It's good marketing. I mean, smart
marketing. John. Oh, sorry, Rebecca.
I just wanted to say our colleague in the ops committee who's not here today, Robert Feltes, kindly put together a reading list for unionization in higher education. I have about 13 copies here if anybody wants it. You could obviously get more information on unionization in faculty. So does anybody want it? And if not, I can take an email list if there's more people interested.
Yeah, that's Rebecca. We could add that to our list.
We can add that in.
Save one page for us.
We'll send it out.
That would be great too.
Yeah, that's
yeah, but this is a Prezi, by the way. So it's not a PowerPoint. I said PowerPoint. It's a Prezi.
Well, what's a Prezi?
It's this thing.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
But you'll receive a link that will take you online to the presentation. It's not you can download it as a PowerPoint if you'd like, but it's a Prezi link. But it goes to my account.
We'll send it over. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It'll take a couple days, everyone, just to sort this out.
All right. Yes.
Okay. There was another question. I'm sorry, but they were very, very organized. And they said they thought that it would be really great if you could have a website from UNM's site with a lot of frequently asked questions, because there are a bunch of things in here like what will the dues be and so forth. If we could put up
some of the frequently asked questions. Yeah.
That exists.
Okay.
So on the president's website, and I think also on the union website, there are FAQs.
Okay.
That you can go to. You know, we're going to have to cut this short for now because we are out of time. But the quality of questions that have come out of this and the number of questions that have come out of this should point out to us that there is a need. If we have these questions, our colleagues have these questions. And I imagine that many of us are probably even better informed than most of our colleagues on these issues. Severa puts a lot of pressure on you, but, you know, I think the work that you guys are doing, it just shows how important it is to get more information out to the faculty so that we can make an informed decision about what it is that's about. And this is a watershed moment in our university's history, right? This is one of those that you don't go backwards from this one. So it is an extremely important vote, and I hope everyone will share this out. We've talked about the role of faculty senators. I think now more than any other time, it's important that faculty senators go back to their units, go back to the folk that they're representing, and share the information as fairly and as balanced as you can. You know, as much as I might want to go to the English department and share Finney's personal thoughts on the union, you know, what I want to do is I want to provide, you know, straight information about the pros and cons as I understand them, and then have our faculty make up their own minds. Do you follow what I'm after there? But we have to do that work over the next couple of weeks. We can't rely exclusively on COG. We can't rely on the union. And we can't rely exclusively on the administration. It's going to be up to us as leaders to go out and do the hard work of trying as best we can to inform our colleagues. Fair enough? We are out of time. Do you have a motion to adjourn?
Did you want to do 117?
Oh, I thought we were already done.
No.
We've got two more items left. Information.
There's two more items, but at least we should try to do D170.
These are the information items. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
I'm ready to get out of here. I got stuff.
Yeah. But let's try to do D170.
All right. So the next item on our agenda is D170. And I'm sorry, Nancy, I forgot. I
think that's the attendance policy.
So this is student attendance policy. My presentation consists in hoping you've read it. Oh, it's not up there. All right, Rick, are you putting it?
Okay.
We're changing the cord. Yeah. So this is an important policy. It's about to go out for comment pending approval in today's body. But I'd like everyone to read it, you know, or have read it, I guess, because we're about to take a... Is this information?
It's information.
Okay, great. So that's all I need to tell you right now, but it'll go up on the board. It's gone through many revisions over a long period of time, with many folks involved in it. Carol Stevens was here, but she's not here now. Liz, did you want to say anything about it?
I don't know the policy.
Not the, okay.
I know it's been widely vetted.
Yes.
By the policy committee.
With a lot of folks putting in. So, yeah, please take a look at it. The revision should be in red. Right, Rick, if you're scrolling down? Yeah.
Right.
And then we can move on to Nancy if you want.
Right. Nancy, please. Next action item.
So I wanted to invite all of you to talk to your colleagues about assessing how we evaluate teaching effectiveness.
That's right.
You don't have to. So in front of you, you have a copy of, I don't know if Rick, if you could put it up, a statement on teaching evaluations that was produced by the American Sociological Association and was endorsed by 17 other scholarly associations, including political science, anthropology, history, among many others, that there has been the emergence of a scholarly consensus that the way in which student evaluations are being used are statistically problematic. So both in observational studies and experiments, we find that they are also biased against women and underrepresented minorities, and that this is an opportunity for evidence-based practice. So institutions are using this as an opportunity to reframe the language even from student evaluation to student feedback, which is incredibly important for assessing effectiveness. But the question is, how are we using it for determining things like hiring, tenure and promotion, contract renewal, and merit raises? And the consensus has emerged around the idea of holistic review that includes not only peer observations, review of teaching materials, syllabi, etc., but also, most importantly, self-reflections. by that instructor. So some of the universities that are using this, the University of Oregon, University of Southern California, Irvine, Nebraska, Lincoln, University of Michigan is also doing this. So there is the consensus that these student evaluations should never be used in isolation. They should be used as part of this holistic approach, and that they should never be used to compare individual faculty members to each other in a department average. If quantitative scores are reported, they should include distribution sample sizes and response rates for each question on the instrument. And that, again, we should really try to aim to create a community of practice that would include training not only chairs and review committees, but also deans on how to interpret them as part of a holistic assessment. So, again, I hope that this is just an opportunity for conversation, because I think a number of us have been asked to think about how do we rate someone an effective teacher, an exemplary teacher, and too often we are not anchoring our practice and policies in the evidence-based research. So there's a lot of resources and bibliographies that cite a lot of the studies that have been done over multiple generations and multiple years and multiple disciplines. And again, I invite you to use this as an opportunity to share this with your community of practice, so that it actually begins conversations on how we can do this in a fair and equitable and accurate way.
Thank you, Nancy. The next item on our agenda is public comment. Do we have any public comment?
I have an announcement and an invitation.
Any public comment? No public comment. We'll move on to senator comment. Any comment from senators?
So I'm also co-chair of the UNM Census Complete Count Committee, and we're having a meeting tomorrow at 9 in the morning in the sub in the Fiesta AV. And it's incredibly important that we start organizing, because every single individual we miss in our complete count for the state of New Mexico is thousands of dollars, not only for higher ed, but for everything from healthcare to roads. So we do urge you to spread the word that this becomes a unit or an item that people speak about in their classes, but also that we speak about in our departmental meetings. What are we doing to organize for a complete count? You can visit the website for race.unm.edu, which is the Institute for the Study of Race and Social Justice. We have a page entirely dedicated to the census, but you're all invited tomorrow, 9 in the morning, Lobo AV in the UNM sub. And they're hiring students as well. It would be great. This is another opportunity for our students to get part-time work.
Any other comments from senators? Our agenda is exhausted. We are adjourned.